Karmanya vadi karaste mapalishu kadachana. Srila Guru Maharaj often quotes this sloka from Bhagavad Gita, which he renders as your duty, you have your duty to perform, and don't be attached to the result. Don't expect to enjoy the fruits of that work. Mapala, mapaleshu kadachana. The fruits are not meant for you. So, and then he cautions, he said, this precludes that if you start, if you're calculating about this and you think, why should I work if I'm not going to enjoy the fruit of that work? So, I'll go on strike. So Srila Guru Maharaj reminds us that, no, you are to do your duty, and the result is for Krishna. Right? And we have to learn this type of working attitude. In another place in the Gita, it's called Yoga Karmushu Koshalam, which you could render as the art of work. What is the art of working? We hear the maxim, a labor of love, means that there may be some labor involved, some inconvenience, some demands of your time, energy, but if it is for someone for whom you have affection, for whom you have love and affection, then gladly, happily, we'll accept that. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written in one of his songs that whatever inconvenience or trouble comes to me that's related to seva, that's a source of joy. I told the other day the example about the mother in labor. Right? So this intense pain comes, especially in that those final hours. It's getting more and more intense until at last the baby is born, and then there's a source of joy. So we have to have this in the background of how and why we move, what it is we do. Rupa Goswami says the criteria for something to be devotion or pure devotion: anya bilashita shunyam jnana karmadyanavritam anukulyena krishnanushilanam bhaktirutama. Not covered by karma and jnana, no ulterior motive, then Krishnanushilana, what's desirable to Krishna, what Krishna wants. Sometimes, in a neophyte position, we think Krishnanushilana, Anushilana, what is favorable, means what I like to do, right? What I like to do for Krishna. Like this Bhakti Vilas Tirthamars of Gaudiya Math in his former life, Kunja Bihari, Vijabhushan. He had a son when he was a grihastha, and this little boy thought the spiritual world, he said, I will be swimming in a pool of rasgulas. That was his idea, because they're talking about the nectar world, and he thought, what would be more? This pool is just full of rasgulas and I'm swimming there and sometimes eating one and then swimming a little more, sometimes diving and eating a rasgula, surfacing, eating another rasgula. So we think, yes, that is Krishnanushilanam. That is very favorable to Krishna consciousness. I told, when I had joined, that time has come, I remember, and it was in May of 71. And so the Sunday feast came, like my first Sunday feast, which was a big deal in ISKCON in those days. And I remember this one devotee, his name was Baladev, and it was the custom of the brahmacharis, everyone really, but especially the brahmacharis, to not only shave your head on Sunday, but what we call back shave. Like you can shave your head, but back shave means if you go in the other direction, then it's very shiny. So we like to do that. Back shave our heads. Like this was, you know, the feast, an opportunity to preach to people. A really joyous celebration. And Guru Maharaj quotes Vasu Ghosh, the famous of Jadigor Nahoita Tabiki Hoita Kemoni Doritam Dehe Radhar Mahima Prema Rasasima Jagata Janatake. His song where he reveals why Mahaprabhu came, the joyous celebration of the glories of Radharani and her Krishna Prem. But in another sloka, I don't know if it's in that song, but another one of his songs, he said, what kind of sadhana is this? Whereby singing and dancing and feasting, that's the path. That is our path. Singing and dancing and feasting. So we heard Srila Prabhupada say this so many times. And I always thought that it originated with him. And perhaps it did. But even Vasu Ghosh in the time of Mahaprabhu, he's also saying how wonderful this process is. So anyway, at that Sunday feast, I remember that devotee Baladev, he was preaching to a guest, and he said, because we hear Brahma, Paramatma, Bhagavan, the jnani's target is impersonal Brahman, the yogi's target is the Paramatma, the super soul within the heart of every living being, and Andantarastam Paramanu Chayantarastam, in the heart of every atom. And then on that point he said, and the yogis, sometimes we hear they're, you know, blazing a fire in the summertime, a circle of fire, and sitting in that as an austerity, like this type of heat. Now, to imagine, when it's hot like this, to blaze a fire circle and then sit in the center and meditate. Or, he said, in the winter, you know, in Badrinath, it becomes ice cold, the water freezing. You have to poke through the ice to get some water to bathe. At that time, they're meditating. So his point was, these yogis, jnanis, yogis, they're performing so many austerities on their path. And then he picked up a gulab jamun, the sweet ball, and with the sugar juice like dripping down on his wrist, and he said, but the bhakti yogi, he feasts, and he threw the gulab jamun in his mouth, and it went like, and juice was like dripping down his chin, and he was laughing, and I thought, I like it here. I'm staying. I thought, if somebody can say something like that, that's enough for me. So, anyway, this idea of Krishnanu Shilana, what is that? Sometimes we're eating gulab jamuns, and other time, Guru Maharaj, he used cliches, but he used them in a apt and appropriate way. And this one is, and other times it's a bitter pill to swallow. So the idea, everything's for Krishna. As one man said, if everything's for Krishna, ahangi sarva yajnanam bhokta bhokta cha prabhureva cha, he says in the Gita, he said, what about us? He said to Saraswati Thakur, what is our position? Saraswati Thakur said, you have no position. Or as Guru Maharaj said, jiva is an impoverished shakti. Only when jiva comes in connection with the ashraya vigraha, chit shakti servitors, does she gain her wealth. Right? Sometimes Saraswati Thakur gave the example of when a girl from the lower section of society, if she marries a prince, right, then she becomes a princess and maybe even a queen. Like that girl, Kate Middleton, she wasn't like from the lower section of society, but still, she married the prince of England, and she could someday become the queen of England by dint of that connection. So that's how jiva becomes enriched, moves from an impoverished shakti to being enriched with an irresistibly divine substance known as Krishna Bhakti, Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavitamati. Kleshagni Subhada Moksha Lugutakrit Sandra Nanda Visheshatma Shri Krishna Karshini Chasa. Rupa Goswami, in the beginning of the book of devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, describing its characteristics, said, a drop of this divine substance is capable of attracting Krishna. Krishna, who is Akarshan, he has magnetic attraction. We are Krishna, and devotees sometimes called Karshni. So, Krishna, Madan Mohan, Cupid is bewildering everyone with his seductive charm. Krishna's Madan Mohan puts Cupid into a state of bewilderment. But Radharani, the ultimate personification, devotion personified to its extreme, to its limits, Prema Rasasima, she's Madan Mohan Mohini. She can attract Krishna. Hare Krishna means also, sometimes Krishna's told as Hari. Hari, one meaning, who steals away. But Hare, Hare Krishna, Guru said, Radharani, she can steal the mind of Krishna. So Gurudev liked to quote this one sloka where a devotee is noticing that Krishna's mind has been stolen. His mind, right? Like we're saying, Radharani can steal the mind of Krishna with her manohar ladus or divine serving mood. So he noticed that Krishna lost his mind, and in this sloka is offering his mind to him. And I see you've lost your mind, so I'm offering mine to you. And one devotee asked Srila Guru Maharaj, he said, and what did Krishna say? It's one of these divine sloka concepts. There's not necessarily an, but there's always some devotee, and then what did Krishna say? To the devotee offering their mind. Guru Maharaj said, Krishna said, oh, what little mind I have left, you want to take that? So we say, Nat Shreyamarman, like in the song, Nitai Chaitanya Bole Nat Shreyamarman. Praying that they will dance within our minds, hearts, as we told yesterday, more or less synonymous. The core. What is the Spanish word for heart? Corazón? Huh? Isn't it? Thank you. I like that. Corazón. Other words, cordial. coronary, cor, corona. That's what it means, the heart of consciousness. That's what we mean. And that's why this thing about when you told sometimes Japan, telling heart and mind, really they're talking about the core of our consciousness. The poet Yeats wrote in one of his poems that he used this expression, deep within the heart's core, or deep within the, within the heart's deep core, something like that, that expression. Because we understand there's superficial levels of consciousness, and then we're talking about something deep when we speak about the heart, beyond superficial mind, really plunging the depths of heart, what is there. So when we speak of being concentrated, what does that really mean? Right? The wives of the Brahmins, the yogic, look, those yogic Brahmins, they were very concentrated on their sacrifice, their yajna. So concentrated that when the cowherd boys approached them on the behalf of Krishna and Balaram for a little prasad, they're saying, that time has not arrived. It'll be some time before there's prasad distribution, children. And sent them away. Right? Whereas the wives of the Brahmins, when they heard this, some of them fainted at the opportunity. So here we can say, concentration means to lose all consciousness. What about that? What if we say that's concentration? To lose all consciousness of this world. When we hear of great devotees fainting, we shouldn't think that means fainting like here, where you're just unconscious. No, they've become so conscious of the upper world that they become fainted here, right? Like those Brahmins' wives. And what are we told? How did they become so qualified as that? It's mentioned. They had not undergone the sacred thread, the Brahminical initiation, or lived in the Gurukula of the Guru, of Guru, and all the different things that you would expect, whether you want to call it, sometimes Purushcharja, prerequisites. None of those things had they undergone. But they, we hear, and just their ordinary dealings, fruit sellers would come, flower sellers in Vrindavan. And while they're buying fruit, vegetables, flowers, sometimes the sellers would say, did you hear what happened the other day in Gokula? No, what? Krishna. Krishna? Yes, Krishna. This, Kaliya. This horrible evil serpent came. Krishna danced on him, punished him, liberated him. They know all the pastimes of Krishna. So there, what are they doing? Krishna katha, Hari katha. They're just doing their normal activities, buying fruit, vegetable, flower, this, that. But they're, really? Yes. Then they're singing some song about Krishna. Kaliya damana. They sing songs. Oh, that's, teach me that song. Didi, teach me that song about Krishna and Kali. I like that song very much. I'll sing it to my friends. So they're hearing songs, singing songs. That's making some impression on their hearts. They're going about their activities. Right. Rukmini. Factoring in Leela, she has not met Krishna. When on the eve of her Swayambara ceremony means unlike the arranged marriage, well, it's a type of, I guess you can say, but the conventional arranged marriage that we associate with India, a Swayambara was like a competition. four very aristocratic girls, princesses, so many valiant men would come and, you know, vie for her hand. There would be some extraordinary feat that you had to achieve that would demonstrate, you know, prowess, virility, intelligence, all that. On the eve of her Svayamvara, knowing that she's likely to be betrothed to someone who is the antithesis of Krishna consciousness, right? And anticipating spending a life with someone who is utterly devoid of Krishna consciousness, who's opposed to Krishna consciousness. She writes Krishna a letter she sends through a Brahmin messenger, inviting him to kidnap her. Now that's a good idea. Surrounded by karmic circumstance that you can't escape, then we have to invite Krishna to kidnap us. But why in the first verse of that letter, told in Charitamritam, no, Chaitanya Bhagavat, that Mahaprabhu, he wanted to, he told his devotees one day that he was suddenly in the mood of Devi Bhav, and he wanted to dress and dance like his potency, his shaktis. So it was arranged, and without going into all the details, when he took the form of Rukmini, everyone was astonished, all the devotees, and they saw him dressed as Rukmini and taking the divine form of Rukmini, and tears pouring down the lotus face of Nimai Pandit in the scarab, and they were like the ink, and with his finger, the sand, the earth below was the paper, and his finger was the writing instrument. And he began to write this sloka, Srutva gunan bhuvana sundara shrinvatam te nirvisha karna vivarai haratonga tapam rupam drisham drishimatam akilartha labham twayachuta vishachitra mapatrapam me. Where Rukmini says, hearing about you, Srutva gunan bhuvana sundara, I can understand you're the most beautiful thing in the world. That impression has come to my heart just by hearing Srinvatamte. And now I understand why there's such a thing as hearing. This is very beautiful. Now I understand why we have ears and we can hear. It's not just to talk to other people and communicate base necessities. Really, the reason we have hearing is so that we can hear about you. How beautiful you are, how wonderful your activities are, how sweet is your holy name, how sweet is the sound of your flute. That's why we have hearing. This from a princess, not any ordinary princess. And this, we might think it's an extreme position, and perhaps it is, but it's real. This is reality. This is why we have the aural sense capacity. Really, truly, it's not just something devotees say. In the 87th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, Veda Stuti, the prayers of the personified Vedas, begins with this question. If the tongue is made out of mundane elements, and you have a voice box, mundane elements, and all this put together, how can you vibrate that which is spiritual? How can you make spiritual sound? This is kind of like our Harinam question. They're addressing that there. How can that which is ostensibly mundane generate, produce something which is spiritual? It's the longest chapter in the 10th canto. So I'm not now going to attend. I couldn't even possibly. I know a few slokas from there. But it's very extensive. But the gist of the answer is, yes, going from down to up, the mundane cannot generate what is spiritual. The tongue with the voice and ether and all, and the element of sound cannot create spiritual sound. But spiritual sound can descend and manipulate the tongue, the ether, the sound from up to down. It can move in that way. So here Rukmini is saying that this, now I know why we have hearing. Now I know why we have eyes. It, seeing through sound, nama rupa guna lila, through sound, now the your divine form has appeared to me. Seeing now at last, long at last, I understand why we have eyes. Their position is without seeing the form of Krishna, of what value are eyes? Only a devotee can understand this. Of what value are eyes if they do not see the divine form of Krishna? And interestingly, this is mentioned in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in the early instructions of Sukadeva Goswami to Parikshit Maharaj, these famous slokas about those eyes are like the eyes on a peacock plume. If they don't behold the divine form of Krishna, that tongue is like the, what are they? Like croaking of frogs, and the ears are like snake. It's very intense. It's very, you know, damning, condemning, very strong language. You think, oh, it's Sukadev, the brahmachari, one of those heavy brahmacharis, like one of the heaviest brahmacharis of all time, Sukadev Goswami. He's speaking like that. But in the Madhya Lila, second chapter, Chaitanya Charitamritam, which is taken to be the summary of the Shesh Lila, Antilila, the final pastimes, Kaviraj Goswami, anticipating that he may not live to finish the book, summarizes everything essential there in that chapter. Srila Gurudev used to sing it sometimes at will, every sloka. However many are there, he would just sing them all. And in the purport, where Radharani is cursing anyone who has eyes that do not behold Krishna, ears that do not hear the sound of Krishna's name or flute, each one of the nose which does not smell the divine aroma of Krishna, all of these things. And in the purport, Saraswati Thakur quotes all the slokas from the second canto given by Sukadeva Goswami to show it's the same. That's what we got from Sukadev here in a seed form, in a general form, being expressed with greater intensity and focus coming from the mouth, the lips, the heart of Srimati Radharani. So Rukmi Akilar Talatma, Sutva gunan bhuvana sundara sunvatam te nirvisha karna vivarai haratonga tapam. Harata, haratonga tapam means all top, all misery, finished. What did Rupa Goswami say? Kleshagni. Klesh means the same thing. Subhada, moksha laguta krit. Krishna's so beautiful. Mukunda, he makes mukti look ugly. Shrutvagunan bhuvanasundara srinvatamde nirvisha karna vivarai haratanga tapam rupam drisham drishimatam akilartalabam. Seeing you, now I understand why we have eyes, and now I've got you by hearing about you. Nama rupa guna lila. You've entered my heart, mind, soul, akilata alabam. I think there's nothing more, nothing could possibly be greater than this. There's nothing more that's necessary for me. It's echoing what was given in Bhagavad Gita in the so-called Samadhi chapter, Samadhi sloka of the sixth chapter. Yam labdva chapram labham manyate nadikam tataha. Talking about concentration. They're saying when you have Samadhi, which is the ultimate concentration on Krishna, you're like, nothing more. I have everything that's possible to have, right? Which connects with the Shraddha definition by labdva, acquire that one thing, and yet everything is got. It's also in the Upanishads. Shudvaganan bhuvana sundarasan vatam te nirvisya karna vivarai haratonga tapam rupam drisham drishimatam akilartalabam tvayachuta vishati patram apatrapam me. So she's saying, so now I no longer care about anything in this world having come in connection with you. So shamelessly, I'm inviting you to kidnap me. That's Rukmini, you know, the principal Dwaraka queen. But in this world, we have to live. There's so many things that we have to do. But underlying purpose is for the pleasure of the lotus feet of Guru and Gauranga. For the service of the lotus feet of Guru and Gauranga. And we may find ourselves in many situations, circumstances, awkward situations. Still, there can be an undercurrent deep in the heart's core, divine remembrance. We hear that Mukunda, the physician, was the royal physician to the Muslim governor. And one day he was giving some medical advice on a balcony, and it was very hot. And one of the governor's attendants took a peacock fan. They're using divine paraphernalia for themselves. Took a peacock fan and shaded the governor. And Mukunda, he's giving medical advice. So we think he's concentrated. Oh, the king, governor, he's suffering from something. He's using his mind ability to, all right, this is what I prescribe to you. But when the attendant shaded him with the peacock fan, Mukunda looked, and seeing the peacock feathers, because he's such a great devotee and has such a magnitude of devotion within his heart, seeing the peacock feathers, it brought about deep remembrance of Krishna. And he thought, the peacock feather, barha pidam natabara bapu karne o karne karam, vibrat basa kanaka kapisam bai jayantim chamalam, run run vain urhaya, adhaya sudhaya purayam gopa vrinde, brindaranyam swapara ramanam pravishad gita kirti. He started thinking of how beautiful Krishna looks when in the morning, and the Braja Gopis are on the veranda and they're looking, there's Krishna and Balaram and the cowherd boys getting ready to go into the forest, and they're playing their flutes and singing and dancing. And Krishna looks so beautiful with a peacock feather in his head. He's wearing a Vaijayanti rainbow colored garland made of forest flowers, and he's playing his flute, and it appears as though a stream of nectar is coming from the lips of Krishna, entering the flute and then showering the atmosphere with the nectarine, a nectar shower of song. Right? Told sometimes when Krishna plays his flute, he has this ability to play all notes at once, but in a beautiful way. Not like where someone just plays seven notes. We go, oh, I can do that. Not like that. Can play them all. It's mind-blowing, mind-boggling. Rundra nambu vritash chamatkriti param kurvan muhustumbarum dhyananantarayam sanandanamukam. Rishmapam, Vedasam, Otsukya Balibin Balim Matulayam, Bogindra Madgurnayam, Bibrad, Bangshi Dvani. That Rupa Goswami writes, what is the sound? What happens when Krishna plays his flute? The sound comes and it cracks a hole through the eight layers of the universe. So, first, you know, clouds, thundering, like they all, what is animate becomes inanimate, and what is inanimate becomes animate. So rivers stop flowing, but things like rocks, stone, they start to melt. And until Tumburu, who's the leader of the Gandharvas, the musicians, the best musicians in the universe, is astonished to hear this sound. And the four Kumaras, who can, they're the extreme, the ultimate meditators. Nothing disturbs their meditation, ever. And the sound of Krishna's flute, suddenly they can't concentrate. Talking about, so here, where not being able to concentrate is very good. They're the best meditators in the world. Suddenly they can't concentrate. Is that a good thing? Yes, it's a very good thing to hear the sound of Krishna's flute and be able to, unable to concentrate. Right. Brahma, who's made everything, doesn't recall creating this. Bali Maharaj, so it's going from the top of the universe down to the heavenly planets, middle, then to the bottom, Bali Maharaj. Otsukya, he is astonished to hear this sound. And we're told at the very bottom is Anantadev with all of his hoods and all the planets on the hoods. And when he hears the sound, starts to sway. And it looks like the planets are going to slide off. So Rupa Goswami says, these are the effects of Krishna's flute. So as they're swooning, swaying, swooning, Mukunda faints onto the floor, thinking of the beauty of Krishna with the peacock. Just the peacock feather is all he saw. But it went from peacock feather to the divine face of Krishna, to his garland, to the flowers on his ears. As observed by the Brajagopis, Radharani and Brajagopis, how they see Krishna. And the sound of the flute and the singing and dancing, Mukunda fainted onto the floor. And the governor and his associate, they're trying to wake him up, and he starts coming to consciousness, and they say, where does it hurt? And he says, it doesn't hurt anywhere. And then he realizes, oh, he'll be discovered. They will discover that he's an advanced devotee, a Mahabhagavata. So he says, I have this one disease. It's similar to epilepsy. So occasionally I lose consciousness, but I'm okay now. Hare Krishna. Any other question? Or does that answer your question somewhat? You ask the question. Yes.
Could you please tell a little bit more about this tradition of, I don't know what's the right word, diminishing yourself in front of other devotees? And also, maybe it somehow correlates when in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is led into tamas to ask questions for everybody. But
yes, right. Yes. But what was the first part about diminishing?
Or maybe it's not the correct word.
All right. Thinking of yourself as being low?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Humility?
Yes.
Or self-denigration? Yes, because we want to make a distinction. Humility should not be equated with low self-esteem. Right. So modern psychology, which is descended from humanism, they're trying to encourage people to believe in themselves. So much so that in the modern world, people are aggressive, beyond assertive. So they've gone beyond submissiveness, humility, being virtuous, admirable, desirable qualities to, in the Darwinian world where only the strong survive and, survival of the fittest, we're being told, you've got to be assertive, aggressive, go for it, because you're number one, you're worth it. All of this kind of thing, which is the antithesis of spiritual culture. Because for the finite, any finite, to think that they are the infinite, or by another name, God, is the ultimate folly or foolishness, right? To think that you're the supreme entity, that the universe revolves around you. Right? So, humility is the outcome of the perceived presence or proximity of greatness. It's not opposing a posture. An actor can act humble. Right? The director can tell the actor, in this scene, you're very humble. Can tell a super arrogant person who may be super arrogant in their normal life, right, in this scene, you're very humble. They may be totally insensitive. You're crying. You're feeling that. Yeah. So we're not talking about an act, a pose, right? Being a poseur, posing as being humble. But humility should come as the natural outcome of being in proximity to greatness. Just as if we're standing on the shore of an ocean, automatically, and we're looking toward the horizon, we see how vast the ocean is, automatically feelings of humility may descend within us. Sometimes we're looking at the sky when it's very clear and you can see so many stars, or through the Hubble telescope, or some space exploration, and then you think, oh, the Earth is one insignificant planet among a trillion stars, and then here on this Earth, I'm one such person, automatically. So on account of perceived proximity to greatness, humility descends or floods the heart. That's the principle. So spiritually speaking, what to speak of when we perceive the presence or proximity to infinite greatness, to divinity, then how shall one feel? So naturally, one will feel insignificant. But one, the other half, that we haven't expressed yet, when we told earlier how the through a drop of devotion, devotee can attract Krishna. So we're told, yes, Krishna is the Supreme Lord. Everything's meant for His pleasure, satisfaction, etc. We're all His eternal servants. And to underscore more, we're His slaves. Right? No rights. But then what are we told? If you can approach, make your approach that way, and it's genuine and real from the heart on account of being irresistibly drawn in attraction, what is the end result? Is where the infinite becomes the slave of the finite. Krishna becomes the slave of the devotee. If you approach Him in that spirit, that's the response. The only difference is, we're finite. What are we giving? You give your tiny little finite self and you get the infinite. The infinite comes under the control of the finite. But what is preventing this is this ego. I'm nobody's servant. I don't bow down to anyone. And it's not even true. It's just, posturing. We bow down all the time to all sorts of people and to all sorts of circumstances. We're humbled, we're humiliated. Not just humbled, humiliated. Prabhupada says in one of his purports in the Bhagavad Gita, when one realizes that material existence is a constant source of perplexity at every step, it behooves such a person to approach a spiritual master. So we have this ego that won't allow us to admit, I'm lost. What to speak of others, I can't even take care of myself. I need help. Right? As Guru Maharaj tells in the beginning of Sri Guru and His Grace, to error is human. And to error is inevitable for all of us, being imperfect. He said, there is an element within us that seeks perfection. Right? That's an interesting situation. Admittedly, we're acknowledging we're imperfect and we're prone to commit mistakes, but there's something in us that's always searching for perfection, that's searching for the ideal counterpart to our heart, what our heart is searching for. Despite statistical evidence to the contrary that you will ever find that in any real and lasting substantial way, we're hardwired spiritually to seek beauty, love, charm, sweetness, personified. That's what we're searching for. The imperfect is searching for the perfect. We're searching for the ideal. We're searching for the absolute. That is what life is. That is what existence is, actually. It's not a religion, a religious thing, a religious idea. It's reality. As once Guru Maharaj said, Krishna consciousness is reality, and it's in your interest to become acquainted with this reality. It's not an Hinduism or an Indian religion or something a particular group of people believe. It's reality, and we have to start thinking of it that way. Therefore, he used that expression, reality the beautiful. Search for Sri Krishna, reality the beautiful. The ultimate reality is beautiful. So whenever we're in the presence of someone who is extraordinarily qualified, we feel, it's natural to feel humble in any field, whoever it is. If someone's a musician and then they're in the presence of a great musician, they'll feel humble and say things like, I don't even want to touch my instrument in their presence. Those kind of feelings come to them. That's what it means. That, so, and that's just someone who's relatively qualified. What are relative qualifications? Janmai, Swarja, Shruta, Srivir, Edamana, Madak, Puman, Naivar, Abhidatumbai, Pamakenchana, Gocharam. Janma, birth, qualified by high birth, Aisarja, wealth, education, beauty, these kind of things. But we're told, Bhagawan, like we say, Bhagawan Sri Krishna, Bhagawan says, Aishwarya Samagrasya Viryasya Yashasya Shriya Jnana Vairagya Yoshchapi Shanam Bhaga Itigana. Who is Bhagawan? Who possesses all these qualities, wealth, opulence, beauty, knowledge, renunciation, strength, fame, all of that, to an infinite degree. And such a person, if you could find someone who had all of these qualities to the infinite degree, such a person would be irresistibly charming and attractive and qualified to be known as Krishna. That is the meaning of Krishna. Krish means like magnetic attraction to the center of all beauty, charm, love, and sweetness. And as I mentioned to you previously, it's comparison with the magnitude of the sun's heat and light. So we think, what kind of heat and magnitude of light and heat is going on there? If we think in parallel, the beauty of Krishna, the charm, sweetness, seductive charm, ability, knowledge, well, etc., then how are you going to feel in the presence of such a personality? And what should be your relationship? Right. So, necessarily, we'll say subordinate. But this is the magic of devotion. So that supreme infinite being, the supreme entity, comes under the control of a tiny finite soul through the power of love. Love, affection, dedication. So Guru Maharaj says in the beginning of the search for Sri Krishna, the ultimate controlling principle is not power, but beauty and love. That's the ultimate controlling principle. It's above power, beauty over power. So, do you know what a superconductor is? You ever heard of them? Superconductors means there are certain ceramics that when they freeze them, they take them towards absolute zero. It means, you know, very cold, right, to the extreme. Like, when we're in Tomsk once, someone was talking about how cold it was in Tomsk, and these two devotees were having a little bit of a discussion. One was telling me, like, it was minus 40. And the other devotee said, ugh, what is this nonsense? It wasn't more than minus 30. So they're used to it being very cold, right? Oh, you know about Tomsk also. So if you go absolute zero is something like minus 300, okay? So we're told certain ceramics, when they approach absolute zero, normally, we know that like wires have some resistance to electrical current. That's why they get hot. Here, when the ceramic approaches absolute zero, it loses all resistance and achieves superconductivity. Full power can go through it with zero resistance. So the negativity or the humility of the devotee should not be misunderstood. It's the power. the power of negativity to attract the positive. Krishna's the positive. This is not like humanist, new age humanism, where you got to be positive. Don't beat yourself up. You know, don't get negative. Just always stay positive. Positive attracts positive. Where does positive attract positive? That's not my experience. When I was a child, someone gave me two magnets. I know if you put the pot, they repelled each other. But positive and negative went like that. So Krishna is the supreme positive. When the devotee, through the genuine culture of humility, descends towards absolute zero, Krishna is irresistibly drawn to that devotee. And they achieve superconductivity, superconductors. There's zero resistance to divine current. So like in the case of Srila Prabhupada, Guru Maharaj told Shaktivesh Avatar, divinely empowered, like God, in power and magnitude to do something extraordinary. So we have to abandon conventional, stereotypical ways of thinking. We have this ego and arrogance of modern people to think that we've just about figured everything out. Couple of things left, right? Like Stephen Hawking or other, within 5 years we'll know everything. Except, how whirlpools work. We have to have the courage to think anew, to allow ourselves to come under the influence of Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, and Vaishnav, so that we'll be enlightened with infinite perspective. That should be a seductive proposition, to go from finite perspective, which at best can only be and always will be limited experience of the limited. We can trade that for the infinite perspective afforded to us by Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, and Vaishnav. So you said two things. That was one, or was that both? Oh, Bhagavad Gita. Oh, that's there. We'll always be under the influence of Maya. But which Maya? There's Mahamaya and Yoga Maya. So, Arjuna's ignorance is Yoga Maya. It's not Tamagun. Ignorance in the conventional sense. Like we talk of Jnana Shunya Bhakti. Devotees, their knowledge-free devotion. Guru Maharaj jokes saying Krishna likes to surround himself with ignorant people, meaning they're not aware of his divinity. They just love him as he is, as a person. That's more charming to him than someone who thinks, he's God. Yes, I am. Very good. Jnana Shunya Bhaktas, knowledge-free devotion. So Arjuna, he, under the influence of Yoga Maya, he's bewildered, he doesn't know what to do, he's in ignorance, and Krishna enlightens him. But interestingly, when Krishna shows the universal form, so Arjuna's friendship, his type of sakya, has some element of Aishwarjagan, knowledge of Krishna's divinity. So when Krishna shows the Virata Rupa, afterwards Arjuna is saying, forgive me now that I see that you're God himself. There were times when I was like a little too friendly. Will you forgive me for that? But that's what Krishna wants. That's what he likes. When Arjuna's very friendly and they're sitting together on the bed discussing something, being Arjuna's charioteer. Krishna's telling us in the Chaitanya Charitamritam, if your love and affection is hampered or constrained by knowledge of my divinity, I'm disappointed. That's the beginning of the book there, where Krishna is saying, I like those who can push this whole divine aspect into the background and deal with me like a friend or a subordinate. Well, you understand? That's very, how can Yashoda whip Krishna? Who can be entrusted to run after Krishna and whip him? Why, she's so great. Gopyadade, Twayukritas, Gosidamatabad, Yate Dushashu Kalilanjana Sambramaksham, Kunti Devi saying, this bewilders me, this vision. Krishna's running, Yashoda's chasing after him to beat him, and Krishna, his lotus eyes, where there's kajal, mascara, all the mascara is running down his lotus eye, and fear, he's crying, running from his mother. She's saying, that's so beautiful and beautifully bewildering. I can't get it out of my mind. By hearing these things, we'll all become properly adjusted. Hare Krishna.